Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com, where we take you down memory lane for a look at professional wrestling the way it used to be, with conversations from those who paved the way. And now the GWH Radio Network presents Peach State Pandemonium.
Thursday night, 8 o'clock Eastern Time. That means it's Peach State Pandemonium. Bo James here along with Bobby Simmons, and we're joined this week by a very special guest co-host, Mark James of MemphisWrestlingHistory.com. How's everybody doing today?
Well, I'm doing wonderful.
All right. Now, Bobby, I was talking to you earlier today. You said you weren't real familiar with Mark. I just want to give Mark a few minutes to explain what exactly he does in saving the history of the sport of professional wrestling in the city of Memphis, Tennessee.
Created a website about a decade ago called MemphisWrestlingHistory.com, and what I did was all the newspaper clippings, I went and collected them all. A lot of people had gone down and just written it out. I actually went and collected all the clippings, scanned them, cleaned them up, put the cards as well as the results on the website, put in a cohesive order, and that's how it started from there. It went to books. I did a couple books on the 60s, 70s, the 50s on those, released that. From there, I started talking to some of the boys from Memphis Wrestling, and they were wanting to do books, which is not an easy thing to do, so it kind of mutated that way, and I helped Dutch Mantel do his two books. I helped Jerry Jarrett do his autobiography, and a little under two years ago, a year and a half ago, started helping Bill Dundee. We released his about a year ago, so that's kind of where it's gone to.
And if you're listening, if you've not at least checked out the website, MemphisWrestlingHistory.com, you need to do that. Mark does a great job. And what got you interested in preserving the history, Mark? You just...
The main thing was I got online, I don't know, like I said, it was over a decade ago in the early 2000s, and there's some really, really wonderful websites out there that document a lot of the territories. There was one for Texas, World Class, there was one for Mid-Atlantic, obviously Georgia Wrestling History, which was doing a great job documenting everything that went down in the state of Georgia throughout wrestling history. And Memphis had a couple little things, but there was nothing really major that documented it all. There were some things, you know, hey, we like Memphis wrestling, great, sis, boom, bah, but there was nothing that showed anything about the old days. So it's kind of one of those things, either, you know, keep hoping someone will do it or take the initiative to just do it yourself and get it done. Because, you know, it's just one of the things, if someone doesn't get it done, no one's ever going to do it. So I just took the initiative, went and did it, did the research, and then just did it myself.
Well, I got to tell you, growing up here in East Tennessee, I watched Memphis Wrestling every Sunday night at 11:30, and used to have to sneak and watch it on my little black and white TV because I was supposed to be in bed. I grew up loving Memphis Wrestling, loving the history of it, and it's such a rich history. You know, everybody knows the names, you know, Fargo, the Greens, the Von Bronners, Lawler, Dundee, they know the names, but not everybody knows the history. And the big misconception is everybody thinks the entire history of Memphis was Jerry Lawler and Bill Dundee.
Right.
And even though they were a big part of it, they were not anywhere near the complete history of that territory or that city.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. Yeah, they were, you know, pretty darn good as it gets in there, but they were the build-up that built to that. And like I said, I've documented it all. I know it goes back as far as I just kind of looked past the 1920s in Memphis. There was wrestling going on in the 1920s. Jimmy Lindos, all those guys were wrestling here back then. I've detail researched it through the 50s all the way back into the 40s. And it's just every week there was wrestling going on. It's just a really, really rich history that you don't realize how far it goes back. But it's pretty cool to discover and document it.
You know, one of the things, looking at that, and you look at where Bobby grew up in Atlanta, where I grew up here in East Tennessee, weekly wrestling pretty much is done. It's dead. There's nobody.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a few places in Middle Tennessee and a couple places in West Virginia where they run the same town every week, but you look at Memphis and you look at Atlanta. They were, and Knoxville was another one here in Kingsport. They were drawing a pretty good size percentage of the population of that town to the matches every week.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm working on a book right now that documents 1977. I did one on 1982 and what it has in it is, at the weekly, like you said, it was a weekly show every week at the Mid-South Coliseum in Memphis. Every Monday night they wrestled. So there's 52 weekly programs. What I did was I collected all 52 weekly programs, put them in the book, then went and talked to all the stars that were there, the wrestlers, as well as the promoter, Jerry Jarrett, Dundee, Lawler, Dutch Mantel, a lot of guys on the cards that were there, and just give you a month-by-month snapshot of what was going on that month, what was happening behind the scenes, why things were going on. And I'm doing the same thing for 77. The reason I'm getting to that is 1977, and I know the numbers, they averaged 52 weekly cards, they averaged 8,000 people a week.
Yeah.
That is pretty good. You know, in summertime they had better attendance. They would sell out. They sold out about 10 weeks that summer, so it was around 11,000. In the winter, they have less attendance, obviously. But when you average out 52 weeks, it was 8,000 weeks. So that's over 450,000 people that year when you add all the numbers together. So it added up. It added up a lot.
What year is this now, 1977?
1977.
And I'm just guessing. Average ticket price was probably $4.50.
Yeah, $3 for the cheap ones, $4, and then $4.50 to $5 for the ringside.
Yeah, about $4.50 everything, right?
Yeah, unless they had the world champion, WWE world champion that year here with Harley Race, and it went up a little bit, but it was just an average card. It was $3, $4, and $5.
Well, if you average $8,000 at $4 a ticket, that's $32,000 a week. That's a chunk of money coming out of that economy.
Oh, it is, and it's the thing was the Coliseum, their operating budget was Memphis Wrestling. So the once-a-week card, they paid their entire yearly deal from the wrestling cards alone. Their operating budget was so every other concert they had in Memphis was gravy. It was over. It was profit.
Jeez.
Yeah, you imagine what just in concession sales what they did with 8,000 people in there every week.
That's it. Lots of hot dogs, lots of popcorn, lots of Coke. They didn't sell beer. They never did that, and that was to promote that family atmosphere, and it worked. But, yeah, I mean, they sold, you know, you had to pay a couple bucks to parking, so that helped things out for them. But, no, they made a lot of money. And like I said, because they would have, usually they would have concerts, I don't know, in a month. They usually did the concerts on Tuesday night and Thursday nights in Memphis. And usually probably 4 to 5 concerts a month at least at the Coliseum on top of that. And so you got to realize all that was pure profit they were making off those guys.
Did Memphis State play basketball in there too?
Memphis State played basketball. In the summertime, all the high schools did their graduation in Memphis at the Coliseum. You know, Memphis is a big city. I mean, I went to Bartlett High School, which is just in the county, but that's where we graduated was at the Coliseum. They would always rent the Coliseum out for that. So, yeah, I mean, it was the local arena. Dallas Auditorium had been, but it had been renovated and was more, it was then called the Cook Convention Center, and it really wasn't used as much. It became a secondary place. And but no, if you were going to do something, if there was a concert in Memphis, it was going to be at Mid-South Coliseum. I believe it's the only building left, or one of two left, that Elvis and the Beatles both performed at. That's still standing.
I'll have to check and see about Kingsport. I know Elvis played the Civic Auditorium here, and I know a lot of other bands did, because Dick Clark promoted the concerts here for a long time. He brought them in off American Bandstand. I need to look and see if the Beatles played here. I know the Rolling Stones did. So, Bobby, do you kick yourself knowing that all those programs from Atlanta pass through your hands on a weekly basis and you don't have any of them?
Listen, I found a box of programs out in my garage here, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago. And they were from all over the country. Everywhere I ever worked, I picked a program up, sometimes multiple programs, because being a referee, of course, if the promoter threw them in the dressing room, you know, most of the guys didn't pick them up, didn't think nothing about them. I'd just grab them, throw them in my bag. And I found this box, forgot I even had it, a little over 500 programs. Gave them to my buddy Randy. He got a guy online somewhere out of Florida. I don't know who he was. But he gave me $900 for them. And I think about how many my kids took to show and tell that I never got back and how many I never picked up and posters I threw away and just, oh, man.
There's always hope. There's always something that shows up that people will find some video, or they'll find a poster or something that it's, that stuff is out there somewhere. There may not be a lot of it, but there's stuff out there.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Memphis is a hard place to find posters from. I've tried for years. It's very few Ellis Auditorium posters or Coliseum posters pop up.
No, there are no Coliseum, I don't think, because Jarrett stopped it before they left the Ellis Auditorium, because he took over booking in 68, and by 70, he had pretty much stopped the posters, and they moved to Coliseum in 71. So
yeah,
there are no really posters with Lawler on them and Dundee and all those guys. They just didn't do them anymore. Gillis kept doing them in Nashville, but Jarrett stopped them in Memphis. So
when you got that strong TV, you really didn't need the posters.
That's it. He knew it, too. And it's like that's where he pushed everything was to the TV. And like I said, I've got about, I think, six of them from the old days in the 60s and from Memphis. And I loaned two of them to Jerry Lawler for his museum he opened up last week. So they're on the walls at the museum. Two of them are, and I got the other three or four here at the house.
That was the same thing in Atlanta. They quit doing posters for Atlanta. Everything was geared toward the TV. We did posters in the spot shows and in the small towns, but the big towns, Augusta, Macon, Columbus, they didn't do posters. It was all based on the TV. Posters got real cost prohibitive there toward late 70s. They had gotten real cost prohibitive. They were part of the lure of getting clubs to sponsor matches was. We covered all the expenses. They made, the club or whoever it was made 25% of the profit, didn't pay any expenses. And the posters had gotten so cost prohibitive, we changed our deal to tell them that the tax and the posters come off the top.
Yeah.
And then we split because we just had to recoup the money because 100 window-sized posters had gotten to be way over $100. They were costing us over $1 a piece.
They're about $2 a piece now if you go through Tribune or Hatch Show Print there in Nashville or Tribune out in Indiana. And I don't even know if the place in Atlanta that printed them for you.
No, Southern Post is out of business. That was that was who we used.
They printed
Bailey
the ones here,
the
too.
Yeah. I always loved Dot Bailey that owned Southern Posters. Her business card had a picture of a devil on it, and she'd hand you one of her cards, and the cards would say, "Hey, I'm Dot Bailey. Who the devil are you?" I always liked Miss Dot. She was a nice lady.
A couple months ago, back in November, I released a line of T-shirts. I did about a dozen, two dozen T-shirts of the old window cards. After Lawler had his heart attack, I talked to him, and I was, "Hey." October, November-ish, right before he went back to Raw. And he kept telling me, "Man, I've been seeing these Rock T-shirts for the old window cards. Someone needs to do a wrestling card shirts." So it's like the second time he's telling me this, so I said, "Well, I'll go ahead and do it, Jerry." He said, "That'd be great. Go do it." So I went ahead and did it, and he loves them. But I did one from the 60s and one from the 50s, and then the rest of them from the 70s that never existed. So, but they look good. They're fun to look at because I did them the same way they used to do the old carts in Memphis, window carts.
Have you ever been in Hatch Show Print in Nashville, Mark?
Yes, I have.
Yeah. Have you been like me, tried to buy them old posters that are hanging on the wall?
Well, the deal is, if you go to any, was it Logan Steakhouse? They've got one with Tojo on it, one of the old Gulas ones. Apparently, they make one of each. So you can buy like a set of their standardized ones. That's why if you go into a Logan Steakhouse, they're going to have one.
I've got a couple of those, but they've got some in the back, on the back wall back there. They have some original ones, and I've tried for years to get them, but they will not part with them. I've tried to get them just to make some copies of them. They won't do that either. So they don't know what they're missing out on.
I know.
So another reason I asked Mark to sit in with us tonight, Bobby, is Mark helped do George South's book, and I remember Mark telling me right before they started on it, he was getting ready to do it when I was down in Ripley, Tennessee, and I told Mark, I said, "Well, if George can write like he talks, it will be great." And,
he wrote every word, every page.
He sure did, and it came with just a few days after it came out. I was in West Virginia, and the guy brought it up to me at the table and showed it to me right in the very beginning of it. George had me listed there as one of his friends that helped keep the dream alive. So that meant a lot to me, knowing that George put me in his book like that. But it is a great book. You know, a few people complain saying it's too preachy or it's this or that. Hey, it's George. And you,
that's
we're getting ready. And if you don't know George and you're listening, you're getting ready to find out. So
if you don't like the book, you're not going to like George, because that book is 100% George. And that's what I told him when we did it. It's like, George, what do I need to do? I said, be you. Put the book you want to put out there, and that's it. Let the pieces fall where they may. Put your book, though. And that's what he did.
It's a wonderful read. Dundee's book's a great read, too. I haven't read Jerry Jarrett's book yet. And
yeah,
I've got a couple of the other Memphis history books here that I just love. I just sit and look at them. You know, relive my childhood.
All those original ones I did, was the reason I did them was I wanted to look at a book that I wanted. If I had saw it, I could not buy it. And that's, you know, I would have to have it. And that's what I tried to do for the guys who cared about, you know, wrestlers back then. You know, old matches didn't make them money. There was no tapes, CDs, you know, whatever. And it's like, the fans, which we were, cared about all that old stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and I just wanted to try to document it all, because, you know, you don't document it, it's gone. It never happened.
When you first started, did you have trouble getting the boys to help you?
Until they saw what you
were doing?
It was probably the mid-2000s when I really started doing the book stuff with it. Bill was rough, but, you know, Bill was pretty rough when you first meet him anyways. You know, he'll threaten to shoot you or something, but that's Bill, you know. You let Bill do his tirade, or, you know, you're trying to rip me off, and what about me, and you know, I did this, and it's like, well, Jarrett said I could do it. Well, okay, what are you doing again? And he'll calm down, and, you know, it's kind of like, you know, getting the mad bull, and you hold the tail and just let him go where he's wanting to go, and then eventually he'll calm down, and you can really talk with Bill. It's kind of funny. Bill's a heck of a good guy, and I love Bill.
Oh, wonderful. I love him. He comes and stays here with me and Misty a couple times a year, and we just have so much fun.
And that's it. He's all fun. He's all business. You know how you stand with him. You never have to wonder if he's upset or happy with you. You'll know.
Yeah. That's it. And he's got to blow his top at least once a day. Well, let him blow his top, and then he's fine.
Yeah. That's it. Let him blow his top. He'll get it out, and he'll move on, and everything's great. And that's so-and-so. He's terrible and this and that. And I never thought this. Was he a bad guy, Bill? Well, no, he ain't no bad guy. He's an okay guy. I guess he's all right. You know how he'll do that. He'll badmouth the guy. He's the worst person in the world. And he'll say, was he a bad guy, Bill? Well, and he'll think about, no, he's a good guy. He's all right. And he'll move on. He'll forget about it. You know, Bill's just great that way. And that's what's so much fun with Bill. It's like, you know, he does get upset, but he blows it. And he gets calm again. And he's happy-go-lucky and very positive. And
when he came to me and wanted to do that DVD that me and him put together, you know, and I told him we had no script of that. I mean, I was such a fan of his growing up, and then I've known him since I was 14 years old, so I knew his life story. And we just sit and talked. I mean, that was the whole, and, you know, we got 6 hours out of three DVDs of matches and just him telling his side of every story that, you know, that everybody's got a side to their story. And we gave Bill an avenue to give his, and I mean, we sit here for a week and watched his career, you know, all day. We watched stuff from all over the country and everything we could find on him that he had, that I had, and other people had donated to us. And then we just sit down and start rolling the cameras, and over 2 days we shot that DVD, and the same thing. I mean, he would get hot a few times in there, and you just let him go, and then he comes back to it, and he goes, I ain't that bad.
Like I said, Bill was, you know, abrasive at first, but then he realized I'm not some fly-by-night guy. I'm really trying to document it. He was very cool with it and helped me tremendously throughout it. Jarrett was the same way. Jarrett was happy someone was trying to do something and document it. He helped from day one. He was one of the first guys I got in touch with and said, anything of mine that's got my name on it, feel free to use it any way you need to. If you ever got a question, call me, email me, whatever you need. I'll tell you the answer if I remember it. Lawler's been very good. I've always been able to call Jerry, talk to Jerry, email Jerry, and say, hey, what happened here? This was going on. I was going to say, okay, this is what happened. This is what was going on. Dave Brown's been great. I was one of the first guys to get an interview with Dave Brown about Memphis Wrestling. several years ago because he just really wasn't giving any interviews about it. But Dave saw what I was doing in the books and just loved it. Lance Russell, I've been able to talk to a lot. Him and his son, Lance Jr., they're both great guys. They've been real supportive of what I'm doing. Like I said, the meat and potato guys from Memphis are the ones everybody remembers. Dutch Mantel, Jimmy Valiant, you know how Jimmy is. You buy the book and he's your best friend for life. He'll do anything he can for you. So you need anything you need. That's it. Just buy the book, brother. And people call me asking me one interview about Jimmy. First, I helped Jimmy. I said, okay, have you bought Jimmy's book? Well, I'm about to. I said, well, you buy the book and I'll answer questions about him.
That's it. And we're going to have Jimmy on here in a couple weeks. Week after
yeah,
next, he's going to do this show here. So
wonderful. That's great. But, yeah, that's, you know, like I said, that's how I got my interview with him was that. And he did it. Anytime I call him, he'll answer any question at all, man. He'll go 110% for me now. That's all you got to do is buy the book, and he'll do whatever you want. And that's why I make me I don't – people don't want to buy the book is what it is sometimes. They'll call me for a shortcut answer. It's like, no.
Yeah.
You buy the book, talk to Jimmy, then talk to me.
That's – you know, and the thing is with that, and same with me being one that, you know, I put out of books, is, you know,
yeah.
It's our life story. We should be paid for it. We're the ones that lived it. We're the ones that took the abuse and everything else, you know. And but you know the history, our history. I mean, you look at how many territories there were in this country alone. Not counting Canada, just here in America in the continental United States. How many offices were running here that the majority of the people don't even know anything about them now? Our history needs to be saved. It needs to be told.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, 35 years ago, around 1980, there's probably, heck, I'd say at least 29, 30, I could think of off the top of my head, offices running where if the guy quit one day, next week, and he could be working somewhere else, legitimately working for a major, not a little fly-by-night joint, but a big deal promotion.
A guy could have a career here in Tennessee. I mean, he could wrestle. He could. You had the Memphis Inn, you had Nashville, Chattanooga, then you had Knoxville, and then you had the King Tri-Cities Kingsport here. Four different little territories in this state alone.
Okay.
And you could just spend, you know, a few months to a year in each one and move on. You could just go back and forth across the state and the surrounding areas that they ran. You could have a 20-year career right here out of Tennessee.
Oh, yeah. It used to be totally different.
And Charlotte was only a few hours away. Atlanta was only a few hours away. You know, I mean, it was just...
Alabama, Gulf Coast, all that down there. I mean, then you get down in Florida. I mean, like, everywhere had their own deal. That was the deal. Everywhere had their own territory, man. And you just go to between them, whatever you needed.
Before I take the break and we get George on here, because he's waiting, Mark, do you think they're going to tear down the Coliseum?
Oh, I'm sure they will. They're pushing so hard. Like I said, I think it's $7 million to renovate it so it's handicap accessible and $28 million to tear it down, and they're voting to tear it down. So, I mean, you know, they want it done. They just don't want that area to be anything other than the stadium for the football games. And they've already torn down everything else. They might still have the Pipkin building there, but I think every other building there has been torn down already. All the little, you know, the flea market stuff was and all that.
Right,
that's
right.
All gone already.
Gosh.
They put tons of grass fields out there now. Parking's all gone. But I bet a year from now it's not there any longer, if I had to guess.
Yeah.
If I had to put money on it, I'd say a year from now.
They're trying to do away with the Nashville Fairgrounds Arena. They're trying to do away with the Louisville Gardens. I mean, we're within years of none of the buildings that were made famous in that territory being left standing.
It's like there's no other place because they've got the big arena at the FedEx Forum where the Grizzlies play now. And the way they've worked it with the Grizzlies is Grizzlies have first denial of anybody who wants to come to town and play a regular concert. So if you got some little group that wants to play in front of 5,000, 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 people, there's one thing, there's no other arena.
Yeah. You got to go to Tunica or DeSoto County down there, don't you?
Yeah, whatever they're calling that thing now. And that's, you know, it's like, why not renovate that so you've got a mid-range arena that can actually hold some things?
It's the same conversation me and Bobby had about Atlanta. Why one of the reasons is, you know, a city that big and they have the Dome and what's the other place, Bobby, that they – but Omni was there before that. In Phillips Arena, there's no mid-sized arenas there.
No.
Yeah.
The only other arena of any size, and they just redid it, would be, they call it McCamish Pavilion. It used to be Alexander Memorial Coliseum on the campus of Georgia Tech. And before they renovated it, it would hold 9,900 and something, just a little under 10,000. But they would not let you use it for anything. I mean, they would not let you use it. That would have been the perfect building for wrestling, but they would not let you use it.
Like I said, sellout Coliseum was around 11.5, so that's right around that same range. And that it was perfect for that. It was a nice round stadium, indoor, you know, facility, and it was great. Not stadium. It was great. And
the only time in my wrestling career when I was extremely nervous was standing there getting ready to go out that doorway and out to the ring at the Coliseum in Memphis. Growing up watching that, living, dreaming to just go see matches there, you know, as a kid. And then to reach that to where, hey, I'm in the ring wrestling in this building. I mean, that was something.
That's probably a lot of people wish you were sitting there watching the matches.
I talked to Tully Blanchard back in 2010. I guess it was 2010. And I said, what was it? He came in 1982. He came in for a one-shot against Lawler. First time he's ever – he came back with Crockett when Crockett was doing the big push in 85. But, I mean, first time just alone himself, he came in 82 once with, and fought Lawler for one match. Got disqualified and never came back. I said, what was the deal with that? He said, all roads in wrestling lead to Memphis. You have to go through Memphis when you're getting your chops, getting your – you know, you have to have gone through there at least once. And that's what he said. He said, I had never been. I needed to go. I went, did my one deal, and then went to the Mid-Atlantic and stuff. And said, but that's what you did. That was, you know, you had to go through there to say you had been through there. So,
and everybody came through there. Everybody came through that building. I mean, it's another thing I love about your books, just looking and seeing who was in Memphis. Same thing here. And, I mean, it's just, it's something. I mean, it's... Our history needs to be preserved, and it needs to be told, and it needs to be told correctly.
Oh, yeah.
And that's a big thing. Well, guys, let's get the first break out of the way here, and then I'll get George on here in just a minute. We will be right back. Peach State Pandemonium. Thanks for listening.
Wrestling fans, Anarchy Wrestling Television tapings are the second and fourth Saturdays of every month at 4236 Level Grove Road in Cornelia, Georgia. For more information on Anarchy Wrestling and on the shows to watch the television product and a whole lot more, go to anarchy-wrestling.net. That's Anarchy Wrestling, the second and fourth Saturdays of every month in Cornelia, Georgia.
If you're hurt, get the money you deserve. If you're in pain, get the money you deserve. At Terry and Peterman, we're personal injury attorneys who take a professional, thorough approach to your accident and injury claims. Don't call some long-distance law firm or satellite office. Don't trust your claim to just anyone. For a free consultation, call the law office of Terry and Peterman today, 229-247-0386, or go online at www.terryandpeterman.com. The law offices of Terry and Peterman, making things right.
Whether you're having an autograph session, personal appearance, or live event, we got just the person you need to contact for all of those needs. SBI Bookings is home of some of the best stars in the wrestling industry today. They provide you with the best talent this business has to offer, from Kevin Nash, Larry Zbysko, Scott Steiner, and many, many more. So who will you contact next time you're planning an event? The men of SBI Bookings. Check them out at sbibookings.com.
Do you remember Tommy Rich? What about Ray Gunkel or Gordon Soley? Can't get those nasty Anderson brothers out of your head? Well, you can catch them again at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Who was on the first card you attended? Who was it under that mask? Remember the first Omni Spectacular or the big main events at the Bell Auditorium? What happened in Columbus on my birthday? Find out at GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com. Whether you want to get back some of your past, or maybe you just want to find pro wrestling in your area, check out GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com.
All right, we're back. Everybody still with me?
We're here.
All right. So if we got anything to say, we better say it now, because once George gets on here, we may not get another word in.
Well, let me throw this in before we go any further, if anybody happens to be listening. We found out a little information about the Wahoo tournament that we talked about last week, and I just wanted to throw in here that if we offended anybody, I will apologize. We found out that Wahoo's widow did have something to do with that thing to start out with. Don't know if she still does or not, but it was a legitimate thing there to begin with, and we just voiced our opinion. Sometimes they don't agree with the other folks, but we didn't intentionally mean to insult anybody. So that being said, we'll let George talk.
No, I agree. I'm glad to know that the family is involved. That was my whole concern, was that the family had no idea about it.
Yeah.
So, and thanks for the information. Hey, we're human. We mess up too.
Yep.
So
that's the first time since 1957 for me, but you know.
Well, that was just one of many that day, I'm sure. So, well, let me get him on the line. He's been holding for a few minutes. George South, are you there with
us?
Oh,
buddy, I'm here. Thank you, man. I'm ready.
So happy to have you on here. And I'm going to tell you, right before we went on the air, my wife come in here and she said, please, don't get George started where he's going to be yelling and screaming.
Buddy. No, I'm relaxed. I've drunk about 12 Mountain Dews, so I'm actually relaxed. So, no, I'm excited, man. I tell you, it's funny. I just saw Susan Green at Reed Flair's funeral yesterday, and she told me that she worked with your wife.
Yeah, it sure did.
I got so excited over that. I told Susan Green, I said, I wanted to have your next match. So, but anyway, guys, thanks y'all so much, Bo, for having me, buddy. I'm excited.
So glad to have you on here. Me and George have known each other for years, and I know we're ones of the very few that are still left out here beating the roads every week and just trying to make a living and feed our families and survive in this crazy business.
That's exactly right, buddy. We are out there every week and, fighting it as long as we can, buddy.
That's it. Now most people know George, and most of them remember you from Mid-Atlantic, but most people do not realize that your first TV exposure came in Atlanta.
It sure did. Matter of fact, I lived here in Charlotte for about a year and was still traveling. You know, driving every shot I could down to Atlanta. And my first TV match ever, of course, was right there with, you know, just simple old Georgia Championship Wrestling. And, with Ole, of course, and then when, of course, Dusty and JJ and all of them came in a short time later, that's when JJ, they actually mailed me a check and saw my address was in Charlotte. And Ole had asked me, he said, I thought you lived here. I said, no, I live in Charlotte. So then I was able to, they couldn't believe I was just getting in the car and driving, you know, to Atlanta every weekend. So then started picking up some shots up here in the Carolinas. And, of course, yeah, all my first TV and first little spot shows I ever done was Macon, Georgia. So, yeah, I had my feet wet down in Georgia Championship Wrestling first.
When did you start there, George?
Where was your first
TV?
I broke into business at the end of, like, it was like 1980. December of 81 is when I broke in, and it was only like 3 or 4 months later that I'd got in touch with Mike Jackson. And, of course, who I love Mike Jackson to death, I would have never to this day got any TV exposure or anything without Mike. And I thank him every time I see him. And, I'm probably the only guy that's glad to admit that, yeah, I paid Mike Jackson a booking fee, and I was proud to do it, Bojay, because I could not have got on TV or got involved any other way. And it was probably January of 82 is when I first started going down there and worked 82 all through there. And, of course, started with my Mid-Atlantic up here. And then, of course, with Mike Jackson, I not only did Georgia, but, man, I got to go to, you know, Bill Watts with him. We went to Florida. Everywhere he went, I went. So just for a young kid, man, I was in heaven. I mean, it's just meeting all these guys I'd read about and seen on TV, getting to work with them. So I wouldn't have traded that time for nothing, buddy.
Bobby, were you still there when George started then?
Yeah, I left. I was writing his paycheck then. I left.
Oh,
and,
my goodness.
I retired and I left the office in December of '82.
Wow.
Yeah.
I tell you, and you know, a lot of the guys used to rib me. I didn't think nothing about it. I mean, you know, a lot of the guys back then were giving Mike Jackson a booking fee, and I knew when some of the boys heard that I was doing it, they all started ribbing me real bad. But man, I'd have paid anybody. I mean, I could not. I called Georgia Wrestling one time, and Buzz Sawyer answered, scared me half to death. Bobby, and I hung up. there's got to be another way to get in down there. So I sure did, buddy. Never forgot that. I thought, man. So I'm very thankful to Mike Jackson because I knew the little ability I had would maybe get me, just get me in there a little bit. I knew if I could just get there. And it ain't like now where there was a, you know, go a training school on every corner and you just, you know, golly, you just, it ain't nothing like it was for us. And so I, go ahead.
Tell them about the first night you went to meet them to talk to them about training with the midget there.
Well, you know, very first time I ever broke in, I was driving a truck. I mean, I'd watched wrestling all my life, and we had a local newspaper up here. I was working in a little warehouse, just turned 18, and a little old bitty ad, about three lines. I still got the ad. It just said, be a wrestler. And that's it. I thought, man, this is pretty easy. And, of course, I went to the address, which was in Gastonia, North Carolina. It was an old rundown building. I still go by the building, son. It's all condemned and boarded up. But even then, it didn't look much different than it did now, than it does now. But, man, I remember I opened the door, and the door fell off the hinges. And I thought, man, you know, broken windows, and walked in, and there's an old ring, like something out of an old Rocky movie, and they had this big Samoan guy, had a little old midget, and then he had this old-timer from up around Tennessee, Rusty Roberts, who had did some jobs for Crockett, and he was actually in the ring. And man, I walked in, they looked at me, and they said, well, what do you want? And me being, you know, young and cocky and full head of hair, buddy, I said, man, I want to be a wrestler. And they said, come on. I said, man, this is easier than I thought. And there was an old-timey lady worker in there, too. I don't remember her, but I got in there, and boy, they beat me to death for about an hour and a half. They ripped my clothes off, busted my nose, and that was before the midget got a hold of me. And they left me in a corner over there, and I just knew I was dying. I said, I got to get out of here. They're going to kill me. And old Rusty Roberts got a hold of me, tied me in the knot, and then I was pulling myself up from that second rope. I said, I got to get out of here. And nose bleeding, tooth chip, and here come that little old midget. And I thought he was going to help me up. I thought he was going to feel sorry for me. And that little old rascal wear back his foot. Man, he kicked me right in the rib as hard as he could. I fell down, crawled out of the ring, and I crawled to my car and said, you know, I hate wrestling. I'll never come back and never want to see it again. And I swear old stupid me went back the next day for some reason. And, man, I've been going back ever since. Now you can't do that. You know, you'll get sued. If they did, you know, if you do that to people, what they did to me, it's against the law, I think. But, man, I tell you, I wouldn't have traded that. I remember just like it was yesterday, the old woman worker got a hold of me, too. And they didn't want me to come back, and I was just dumb enough. And a week later, they gave me my first match. And the first match I ever had, I didn't have no boots, no gear. All I knew is I needed wrist tape. And one of them guys let me borrow some old athletic tape, and I didn't know what to even do with it. I just wrapped myself up where I looked like a mummy, folks. And, man, I went to the ring, and the old guy throwed up that I was wrestling. I thought I killed him. And he climbed out from under the ring, and that was the end of his career, I think, after that. But I thought, it's got to get better than this. And it did, of course.
That's where you asked the question. Do you want to be a wrestler, kid?
You know. That's exactly right. That's right. I thought, well, maybe I need to rethink this. But and I knew even then, you know, I was talking to Lance Russell one time in WCW, and I asked him about when he was down there announcing a few years ago, and I asked him about Jeff Jarrett. You know, and I said, you know, because I always loved Jeff Jarrett. And I remember Lance Russell told me that what a lot of people didn't know, that Jeff Jarrett, even before he broke into business, he was in that ring every day. You know, he'd work out with himself sometimes, you know, in the ring. And it kind of reminded me that that's how it was when I started, that, man, any chance I had, I would get in that ring, Bo. And many nights it'd be me in there by myself, but just trying, didn't know what I was doing. But just trying
who,
to.
Who helped you the most when you first started?
It was probably
who was there
Rusty
to kind of guide you.
Yeah, it was probably Rusty Roberts. Now, he had only did some jobs here in Crockett, and he was staying here before he left to go back to Tennessee. And I just started going to a few shows with him. And there used to be a guy, I don't know whatever happened to him, but I love this guy. He's from Tennessee, big old Samoan. I think his name was Nick.
Yeah, Big Nick. He lives in Morristown. His health's not real good now, but I hear from his family and different people that know him every now and again.
Oh, my goodness. Well,
I
remember the first time, he's a big old guy, first time I walked up to him, I squeezed his hand. You know, I was going to be tough and squeezed his hand. And I remember he reached with his other hand and smacked me right in the forehead. And that was he smartened me up right then. So, Kim and Rusty Roberts, I just ask a lot of questions. They told me to shut up a lot. Like, you know, I hear that a lot now for some reason, Bo. But just traveled with them and learned a lot with them. And so I'm very, very grateful for what they did. And to see, even then, Bo, I wasn't like a lot of these young kids now. Man, I kept my mouth shut. I didn't know much, but I knew to shut up, you know, and watch and listen. Got to know Ron Sexton pretty good. I worked him, man. Some of my first early matches was Ron Sexton. And he taught me a little bit. I was just trying to pick up as much as I could, you know, from any of the guys.
What was, when you went to Atlanta to do the TVs the first time, what was the biggest thing that made you realize there was a difference from where you were working those little shows in the Carolina to what you were part of there in Atlanta?
Well, you know, I wasn't in Techwood Drive studio 5 minutes, and then you know who Ole was. I mean, Ole let you know quick, no matter who you were, that he was the boss, you know, and that he run things. And what was so amazing, that was, I knew Ole and Gene, of course, from Mid-Atlantic, but, man, all of a sudden, Ole's right in your face. And I was scared to death. I mean, just seeing all those guys around, of course, Tommy Rich, all of them was there. And one of the first little angles that they put me in, it's when Rip Rogers was, everybody he would beat, they'd spray paint their hair pink. And, man, I wanted to get my hair painted pink so bad, just so I could go to work the next day with pink hair, folks. And, of course, that's when they had Rip Rogers and Tommy Rich feuding, so they finally painted my hair pink, and I thought, I was so proud of that. I wouldn't wash my hair for about a month. And where I went, I don't want everybody to see where Rip Rogers spray painted my hair. But I knew right then, quick, I mean, the first match I ever worked on TV ever was with Jerry Lawler and Jimmy Valiant. And that was just, well, my first match, I screwed it up. That's when I wrote my book that I kicked out of Lawler's. I didn't know what his finish was. And, you know, he told me the pile driver, well, he did the fist drop. He forgot, well, me, I kicked out on the fist drop. And, man, I came in the back and Ole cussed me up one wall down the other. I didn't even know what I'd done wrong, Bo, but Ole sure told me. He said, man, Lawler's beat Hogan. He's beat Flair. He's beat Harley Race. He's beat everybody with a fist drop, and you kicked out. I don't even know what I done wrong. And I'll show you how great of a guy Lawler is. Lawler came right in there and told Ole that it was his fault, that he had forgotten that he did tell me that he was going to use the pile driver, and he didn't. He'd forgotten. But I did. I may be the only one ever that kicked out of the fist drop. But that was the first tape. The second tape, they put me in there with the real old-timer, that Devil Blue. And I think it was Tony Marino that put the hood on. And, buddy, he beat me to death. And, of course, he cussed me when it was over that I screwed it, that I killed his career. You know, I'm sitting there beat to death, Bo. I'm thinking, now, how'd I kill your career, buddy? But, man, I tell you, so it's a wonder I didn't quit right then. But I tell you, back then, you just hung on for your dear life. Jimmy Garvin did an interview up here, gorgeous Jimmy Garvin, a couple weeks ago, and he made so much sense because he talked about the first 3 or 4 years of his life. He just tried to survive. I mean, his career, he just tried to survive, Bo. And that made me, you know, it reminded me of us. I mean, that's how it was with me. I just tried to forget doing a headlock or something. I just tried to survive the first, 3 years.
And you look at all that talent that you were blessed to work with starting there in Atlanta and Charlotte. Man, they had all-star teams both places.
I remember some of the best matches were first and second. I mean, from the first match to the main event, guys, everybody could work on there. And it was just amazing. They did not, there was not a bad match even on the TV. Even when you went out on TV, if it was with Ron Ritchie or, man, I used to love to work Ron Starr a lot down there because, man, those guys were unbelievable. And they made, I didn't even have a clue what I was doing, but they made a match out of it. And that was some of the best matches that I ever had as I was learning. And like you said, with Mid-Atlantic down there, I mean, some of the best guys were some of the underneath guys that you never heard of much. But I loved that time. And, of course, wasn't long after that's when Memphis started bringing some guys, sending guys. Everybody was. The greatest thing about Georgia Championship Wrestling is you never knew, I mean, being a big wrestling fan like I was, you never knew who was going to show up. I mean, you'd have guys from Portland 1 week. You'd have guys up from Florida the next. I mean, just everybody was coming through there. And, man, I loved it. And I knew only he would never admit it, but I remember he went up to Mike Jackson after about the third TV. And after I'd worked a couple guys and just tried to make them look good, and I remember Ole came up and he said, it's about time you got some, you know, kids in here that knew what they were doing. And, boy, I remind that to Ole now that he actually put me over a little bit. Of course, he denies it, says he never said that. But I said, yes, you did too, buddy. So just some great, great times. I remember I drove one time in an old Trans Am, and this is when I learned how cold this business is. I blew the engine up. I didn't know. I got in this old Trans Am from Charlotte. Man, I was about 30 miles outside of Atlanta and blew the engine up. And so me, I just, you know, hitched a ride to a payphone, called down there. And I remember I talked to Mike Cash and said, I can't make TV. I got to get this car back to Charlotte. And he said, are you booked today? I said, well, yeah. I said, didn't you hear me? My car blowed up. He said, you better be at TV. And I mean, I didn't care if I was dead on the side of the road. But, I hitchhiked to Atlanta TV, and I made the shot. But I thought, man, they don't care if that car's broke down. You better get to that booking.
Yeah, you got to give 2 week notice if you're going to die. You got to make sure we can find somebody to, you know.
Yeah, you got to get somebody replaced. And, that was just me doing TV matches. And they said, you better be here.
You know, you were talking about going to that building and answering that air, George. You know, I told a kid the other day, he was, I forget what even came up about it, but it just made me mad. And I told the kid, I said, I'll tell you something. I said, 35 years ago, I said, they would have stretched your butt and sent you home crying. I said, you'd have never saw the inside of a ring in front of a crowd.
That's right, buddy.
I mean, these guys today go to some little training school, and the guy running the school don't know what he's doing. And
that's
then,
right.
You know, and it's funny, yes, the guy, how long you been working? He'll go, oh, 3 years. Well, how many matches you had? Oh, I don't know, maybe 15.
That's right.
You know,
that's
and we
right.
used to do that many in a week.
That's exactly right. Bob, I tell you, I get so aggravated up here, and Bo knows. I get so mad up here because, you know, I'll tell you a funny story. I have a little training school up here, and I've learned that, some guys are respectful, don't get me wrong, but 95% of them, they're tired of their regular jobs, and they just think they're going to get rich real quick. And I tell you that. I get them in there. I tell you, she just passed away, and it broke my heart. We had this young lady that was from Texas, and she had got run over, Bo, by a car when she was a little girl. And it had paralyzed her, but she was the strongest young lady that I've ever met in my life. She loved the business. So she moved to Charlotte, got her apartment, took care of herself, and joined my school. And I figured, at least if I had her, I could protect her a little bit. But she was tough as shoe leather. And she used to get so tickled when I would throw these guys around. And they would say, man, you're too rough on me. And here's this precious girl. You know, her name was Vicky, and I loved her to death. And she had just been in a pain all of her life, but loved our business, could take any bump in the world. And actually, I was able to let her have a few matches, and she was just tough. She was doing so good. But she used to get so tickled when I had to throw somebody on her head because these grown men that are healthy would be complaining. And she used to sit over there, you know, just laughing. And I could still hear her laugh to this day when we'd get some smart aleck in there that just was, you know, what amazes me now is, you know, you just ask them to sweep the ring, Bo, and you'll have to fight them. I mean, they've never even heard of that. Bobby, and that's the biggest thing. But you know what was so amazing is when Steamboat and Flair both brought their kids to me, I thought, oh, here we go. These are going to be some spoiled kids that did. But they were the most respectable boys I ever met. And I get aggravated now, you know. Yeah.
Hey, George, it's Mark.
Hey. Oh, hey. Listen, boys, just tell me to get off here and interview
no,
Mark.
No. They had me on early. No. They had them early. They had me on early. Tell about the disrespect. Tell about what old Gene Anderson did.
Man, listen, I'm going to tell you.
In the book. You remember in the book?
Yes. Buddy, I'm going to tell you. Nelson Roll and Gene Anderson used to train some of the young kids that came through Mid-Atlantic, and they had a little school up there. This was in Nelson's barn. He had a ring set up in his barn.
I've been there when he had that there. I've been there a couple times.
Man, I tell you, on Saturday afternoons is when they would take phone calls all week, and then Saturday afternoons would be when they would give everybody a tryout. And whenever we could, we'd go up there because Nelson and them didn't want to take any of the bumps or anything. Of course, Gene had just had like four heart attacks. And but he loved being around it. And I tell you, this one particular Saturday, man, it was hot outside. And they had about 15 guys. And I think it was me and Tommy Angel was up there just kind of helping the guys. And there was one guy. I wish I could meet him again just to see him. I mean, because he brought a lot of laughter to my life. But this one guy, just hippie-looking guy, big old, you know, long hair, beard, he said the whole day he kept complaining about he didn't want to get sweaty. And he said, I just hope this don't take long. And, man, I just knew that if Gene or Nelson heard him, they'd kill him. So it went on for about an hour, and they brought us in the barn. And, of course, they kept the barn door open because there was no air conditioner or nothing. You'd about die in that old barn. And I'm talking about a barn that still had horses in it. I mean, so the horses would walk around while you're sitting there by the ring. And that was some of the toughest matches I had when Nelson was in that barn in front of his horses. I swear he showed off in front of them. But that particular day, this guy, he just wanted to leave. And he just said, man, I got a party to go to. And he said, I just hope we can get out of here. And I thought, buddy, I hope they don't hear that. And then about 10 minutes later, he took a big bag of pot, of weed, out of his pocket.
Oh,
and right in front of Gene and all of them, he said, can somebody hold this? He said, I don't want to squash my pot. And I swear, buddy, I can't do it justice, but Gene Anderson, who never got in the ring, he doesn't have four heart attacks, couldn't hardly move. Man, took him like 4 days to stand up. I mean, he was just hurting so bad. And he always wore old sweatpants and flip-flops and had an old dress shirt on. He used to keep like 15 ink pens in his front shirt pocket. And that particular day, he just stood up. And I swear, to this day, I think he was like 10 foot tall. And he just looked at me, and he said, shut the door, kid. And, man, I went over and shut that door, Bo, and it shut. And of course, all you could see is the daylight coming through the cracks in the door. And it took Gene about 15 minutes to get in that ring with that kid. But I think he killed the kid. I'm not sure. I mean, he did stuff to that kid that I wrote the book that I can't sleep at night sometimes. I mean, he beat this kid. I mean, stretched him. The kid throwed up. And Gene didn't let up. And he finally let that old kid go, and that kid took off a running. And but I tell you, I told Gene he ought to be working for the Just Say No Drug program after that, guys.
You know, George, you didn't have to worry about that because you had so much respect for everybody that you worked with. And we all did. We lived this business as kids and just dreamed of getting a chance to get in there. And we got to wrestle with all of our heroes and see everybody that we like. And it just,
you know, when I first started working shows up here, Bo, I remember guys telling me, well, you can go work for so-and-so. Remember Johnny Hunter, who ran a lot of shows up here right when I broke in. Everybody said, well, he don't pay you. And I said, I don't care. And they said, well, matter of fact, you'll probably have to pay him something. And I said, okay. And, man, I don't care. So I think the first 3 years working shows up here, I paid the promoters to let me in the ring. That's why it never bothered me about, you know, I know, this book and fee thing that, you know, a lot of the guys don't understand. But I was, man, I never had a second thought I knew Mike Jackson made a lot of phone calls for me. He took a lot of heat for Mike Jackson got a lot of heat for some of the guys that came to TV and that really, really couldn't work a lot. I mean, or they'd be, you know, smart alecks. And so Mike got a lot of heat for that, too. But I never had a problem with any of it, man. I just had a great, you know, just great, great times. And but, yeah, when I saw Gene, I knew them, buddy. If I ever thought about doing drugs, that changed my mind right then, buddy.
I was in the ring with Gene Anderson 1,000 times, and when you set a barn with him and Nelson Royal, there wasn't enough money to have got me to go over there.
Well,
people,
see,
people that
Robert
never knew
up.
Gene or never was around him, Gene had fingers. They were little bitty short fingers. I mean, they were
yeah.
For a man that size, his hands were incredibly small. But when them were the strongest fingers I've ever had wrap around my throat.
That's right.
I mean, he was, oh, geez. And you never wanted to do a test of strength with him. Never.
No,
not even working.
Because
he would short finger you. He got Tiny Frazier one night in Atlanta. I was sitting at the timekeeper's table, and Tiny put his hands up for a test of strength, and he looked at me and winked. And he short-figured old Tiny, and he dropped to his knees selling, and Tiny was on his tiptoes squealing like a pig. It was the funniest thing I'd ever seen in my life, and I couldn't laugh. And Gene would just sell the more and just kept squeezing. I thought, oh, my God, he's going to kill him.
Well, he used to grab me under my arm when WCW was out at that center stage. Gene worked there for a little bit just getting guys to go to the ring and getting them set up. And I'd always be waiting to get ready to go through that curtain, and he'd grab me right under my armpit, and he'd bring me to my knees to where I cried. And then all of a sudden they'd say, you know, George, go to the ring. And man, many times now I can go back and look at an old tape, and you can see me go out there selling my arm like crazy. And that's... People say, what happened to him? And I'm saying, that's because Gene just beats the crap out of him, you know, before I went to the ring. So they'd go, you know, take a break, go to me in the ring, and I'd be holding my arm like it was broke. And because that sorry rascal, he'd pinch my arm. But I tell you a funny story. Is I wrote about this in the book. Right after I broke into business, before I got married or anything like that, I'd met, they used to have this nightclub up here in the Carolinas that all the boys used to go to, and called Dixie Electric. And it used to be, of course, it no longer exists, but I used to go not to pick up women or drink, but to go see what wrestlers were there, Bo. That's how bad I had. And one night, I swear, I met Gene Anderson's daughter there. I'll never forget it. I walked in, and she come right up to me. I don't know how she knew me, but she said, oh, great. Another wrestler. You know me, I'm thinking, man, I've already got recognized, Bo. I ain't been on TV much. But she said, oh, I said, what's the matter? You don't like wrestlers? She said, not really. She said, my dad's one. And I said, yeah, right. And all of a sudden, she pulled out, like, a photo album of the Anderson brothers. And I'll never forget, I forgot all about the women that was there, Bo. I mean, any of the party. And I went and sat at the table and looked at Gene Anderson pictures for the next 30 minutes. But, man, I dated her a few times, and the only reason I dated her, I mean, she was a sweet girl, but it was, man, I never caught, Gene was so busy on the road then, but many times I'd go to her house and we'd eat supper with Gene Anderson's boots would be laying over on the floor. And I tried my best to steal them things, let me tell you. Man. But I never, he was always on the road. I never got to see him. That's probably a good thing. But Brad Anderson told me a story. I didn't even know this, but I wrote Gene Anderson a letter one time to the Crockett office, and I was so stupid and back then and ain't much smarter now. I even put in a letter that I dated his daughter. How about that help me get a booking, Bo? Brad said, man, I was there with my dad when he read that you put that in there on your resume. But I'm desperate. I'd do anything to get a booking, let me tell you.
George, how did the things change in Atlanta from when Crockett came in and took over? Because you were one of the few that actually was there on the Atlanta end that actually stayed.
Man, I tell you, I was right there the day. I remember we walked in that rest right off to the side there in that little studio, and I remember Ole walked in that day. I mean, just without a warning. I mean, we had all the whole Georgia crew from Ox Baker to Buzz Sawyer, Tommy, all those guys were, I mean, we were just right there getting dressed for a TV taping. The RPMs, Mike Davis and them had just come down from Crockett, you know, for their big break. And Chick Donovan, everybody was there. And I remember Ole walked in and said, guys, I want your attention. And we thought he just had the TV sheets in his hand. He said, I want to introduce to you the new owner of Georgia Championship Wrestling. And I swear, we all, everybody's laughing. And all of a sudden, Jim Crockett walked in. And, buddy, you could have heard. I was hurting. Man, guys were cussing and everything. And he just said, hey, I'm Jim Crockett, the new owner. He said, I want to introduce to you the new booker. And here comes Dusty Rhodes. And I swear to you, Bo, Dusty pulled out a sheet of paper, and he said, this is who I'm keeping. If your name ain't on the list, you're out of here. And I swear to you, he just read down that list just like you do in a high school football game, picking teams or something, Bo.
Yeah.
And it was so funny because I felt so sorry for Mike Davis and Tommy Lane. They just moved to Atlanta, and their name wasn't on the list, buddy. And I never forget, poor Chick Donovan walked over to him because his name wasn't on the list. He asked Dusty. He said, well, if my name ain't on there, am I here? Am I staying? And Dusty looked right at him and said, listen, I've got my nature boy. And I thought, man, of course, I was so unimportant, you know, my name wasn't even thought of. So, but I saw all of that, and it wasn't but a few weeks later. Dusty looked at Buzz Sawyer and said, you and Tommy Rich are on probation. And so they kept them around for just, for a little bit. Everybody saw the writing on the wall, and then here come, you know, the Magnum PA videos. And, of course, they started bringing some of Crockett's guys in, and then, buddy, boom. And then the rest was history, buddy.
They sent Cornette and Midnight Express in there. They kept them out of Charlotte for a few months, just had them in Atlanta.
That's
doing
right,
that,
buddy.
Doing that TV.
Yeah. And, you know, being young and in the business, I didn't know what was – I mean, I knew more of the Mid-Atlantic guys, of course, just from, you know, up here, being up here and on the TVs and stuff up here. But, man, I saw – what was so cool about it, especially breaking into business or being an underneath guy then, man, I was making some money, Bo, because we were doing Charlotte TVs and, Georgia TVs. And they didn't have hardly – they had the same crew. We were just going back and forth and – man, it was great times, but you saw the changing of the guard, buddy, because even the guys that from Georgia that they kept slowly started disappearing. And then here come all the Crockett guys, and of course JJ came in, did such a unbelievable job, and next thing you know, it was just a whole different ball game. And it just seemed like it happened so quick too.
When did you realize that you were going to stay? Because, I mean, you were there all the way up through WCW.
I sure were. You know, I was, and a lot of folks, you know, wouldn't understand this, but I know y'all do, I was making some good money, buddy. And I tell you, people would say, well, back then the underneath guys didn't make much money. But, buddy, we did. And the thing I love about Bill Watts finally coming in Atlanta for that short time was his first act of Congress was getting the underneath guys more money. You'll never hear nobody talk about that. They'll say bad things about Bill Watts. But the first thing he done, when they started paying us trans to drive to Atlanta, that was all Bill Watts. He got that for us. I tell you, they used to pay the boys. They'd give you an extra $100 for driving. I never seen so many guys drive from Charlotte in my life, Bo.
Yeah.
But that was all Bill Watts just saying, hey, we're gonna start taking care of these underneath guys. So I knew, man, I ain't never. It's like I always said, you know, about leaving Charlotte. When people said, you know, why didn't you and Gene ever really leave Charlotte area or Georgia? He said, man, we didn't have to. And man, I was getting my feel of getting to go to Florida TVs with Mike Jackson. So I was getting to travel and getting to work other places. But man, staying right here, buddy, and then living here in Charlotte, man, it was perfect for me. Oh, gosh, I miss it like crazy. It was perfect. I was doing three or four TVs a week, plus picking up one or two little spots. Man, I was doing great.
Yeah.
So,
I'm
one of the ones that miss it.
I was in town with Joe Cazana the other week, and I was telling him, I said, between you and Joe, you two had as much TV time as any of the stars did every week, because you was on every tape.
Man, I want to tell you, I want to be getting paid for some of this stuff that WWF's coming up with, because every time they show a TV or, from WWE 24/7, I'm all over that stuff. But,
yeah
we there was a time, I've got tapes here, where out of three TVs in one week, I mean, I'm talking about three different programs, I'd be all over that. And then they come up with the idea of having me and Gary Royal put a hood on. So then I was on there two more times a week. So they were getting their money's worth out of me, buddy, let me tell you.
Tell the story about how you got picked for your match with Flair when he went 20 minutes with you on TBS.
Well, you know what's so amazing about Rick is, and if a lot of fans could remember, is, and I don't blame him, he used to hate to work early morning TVs because he always had to catch a plane, and, you know, he's always dressed in those beautiful suits. And, I mean, it was so hard to work an early TV match, sweaty, get the shower, and trying to catch a cab to get to the plane, because he always had a show somewhere in the country that night. And so most of the Saturday mornings, he would do TVs. Well, you know, there's always a little bit of heat between Dusty. They always kind of friendly bicker back and forth. And, I laugh sometimes because I think Dusty had him work TV sometimes Saturday mornings. And those studios were so cold, Bob. You know that, buddy.
Those things were,
they had to keep it cold. To keep the cameras and them running, because cameras couldn't overheat, but it was freezing for us. Oh, my goodness. So I know Flair hated to do it, but this one particular Saturday morning, buddy, he said, all right. He said, I'll work TV. And he said, give me George South. And I want you to know, I come as close to, like, having a heart attack as I've ever had in my life. And, man, we went out there, and I swear I had no clue what I was doing, still don't, but, buddy, I did every move. You'd have thought it was like Magnum TA against him. I mean, I slammed him off the top. I even punched JJ when he jumped up, hit pulse, drop kick, and I was so blowed up, Bo James. I about died. I mean, we actually went to the first commercial break, and I thought finally maybe Rick will grab a hold. But man, we went to that first commercial, and he kept going. He never grabbed a hold. And so for about 20 minutes, that was probably the most – I mean, I was so blowed up. I remember I crawled back to the dressing room. I couldn't even stand up. I was so blowed up. I only think Rick was even breathing twice, you know, breathing hard. But that – you know, and that was what was so neat, Bo, is Claire could have ate me up for 20 minutes. But, man, I bet you 19 minutes of that. I thought, hey, buddy, I thought I was winning the world belt. So that was what I missed most. You know what's so amazing is even, and that was 20 years ago, even today, people will come up to me at the matches sometimes and say, man, I remember that match where I thought you were going to beat Ric Flair. And so that shows you how strong that was. And I thank Flair to this day. And see, back then, Bo, and y'all know this, Bobby, is you didn't tell somebody you could do an arm drag. You kept your mouth shut. And hopefully some move, you know, your ability would speak for itself.
Yep.
I remember when Art Barr came to Atlanta as the juicer, and I never met him, never met him. And I worked in his first TV, his debut. He came up, shook my hand, Bo, and he said, Bobby, he said, I never met you. He said, but Bobby Eaton told me that when I'm in the ring with you to just keep my mouth shut. And Art said, that's what I'm going to do. And we went out there and had a great, great match. And I always thank Bobby for saying that, because Bobby didn't have to, you know, say that. But see, you're a buddy back then. That's why nowadays these shows, though, I get so mad, because after about 5 seconds, I can tell if you're an idiot or not.
Yeah.
But listen, I just had this guy this week come up and tell me he just got back from World Class. I said, brother, World Class been shut down for 10 years. He said, well, maybe it wasn't World Class. So, oh, my gosh. So,
you know,
after
he's
about 5 minutes, I can tell.
That is a testimony, too, of your work ethic, though, George. Flair picking you, and then you had Art Barr's first match there. You had Brian Pillman's first match. You had the Road Warriors when they came back from AWA, made their Charlotte debut. You had everybody's debut.
Oh, I appreciate that, Bo.
They put everybody with you because they knew you was going to make them a star.
Well, you know, Animal told me one night, he said, we get so mad when we come to TV and you've already been put in the match. And being young then, that's what guys don't understand, these young kids, is, man, if there was an art form to making these guys look good. And I learned quick, too, that, you know, either you can make Animal look good or he's going to make you make him look good.
Well, speaking of that, their debut, it was in Asheville when you and Ron worked with them. Do you remember that, where he ducked the clothesline?
Man, I sure do. Yes, I do. I still joke with Animal about it. I mean, I'm telling you, that was one of the most amazing things. I mean, what was so funny, that Ron Rossi, you know, he ducked Animal's clothesline, and Animal almost tripped. And you could hear some fans laughing.
Yeah.
But what was so amazing about that match, if you go back when the Road Warriors first hit the ring in that match, you can see Tommy Young reaching down, telling those guys to take care of me. And I Tommy told me later, and so that was kind of neat. But, buddy, when Ron Rossi ducked it, Animal punched him right in the face, knocked him right out. And then Hulk spit on him when they were leaving the ring. So, oh, my goodness. And so, well, I thank the Lord I didn't have to get back in. But
was there anybody because there was a time when they took any muscle head that they thought that they could make a star and tried to do something with them. Who was the hardest one you had to try to have a match with?
Bo, I tell you, they brought this guy down, and I know you're going to know him, or Bobby may know him. He came down from Canada, and he was only here for like probably 2 days, but he was, gosh, what was his name? Had long hair. He reminded me of like a, maybe a Jeff Sword type. But this guy was juiced up. He was a big star, I guess, in Canada. But he came here, and he wore a big leather sleeve on one arm, Bo. That was kind of a gimmick they gave him. I can't remember his name. Dad, burn it. I'll think of it before we get done with this interview. But they brought him here for a short time and told me how he was such a big star in Canada, and he came down here, and brother, he about killed me. And it used to be when the guy would come, they would give him a dark match, and I tell you who really about killed me one night. They brought that Kevin Kelly, that Nails for WWE.
Yeah.
They brought him down here right before he went to WWF, and I laugh now because they gave us a dark match, and this guy was nuts. I mean, he grabbed Jackie Crockett's $100,000 TV camera because that was working and trying to hit me with it. And Jackie's fighting him over it. They ain't going to let him have the camera. And I'm thinking, Jackie never let him have it, thank the good Lord, because I'd probably be dead. But they had a lot, you know, during that time, anybody, they'd go to the gym, and if they saw a guy that was, like, juiced up to the max, they'd try to give him a match. And that, you know, Scott Steiner was one of the ones that was big, but he, you know, he came in and did some TVs, and then they sent him to Memphis. And that's where he went up our course and learned to work stuff like that. And he did it the right way. But most of these guys, man, I could tell after a while that, yeah, I'll go out here and work this dark match. But I know the guy ain't going to be back. And 95% of the time, none of them was back. I'll tell you who I liked a lot, and I don't never understand, they brought Dale Wilkes down when he was doing the Wahoo, brought him to Atlanta to give him a little dark match when he was doing that Trooper thing in AWA. And, man, I worked him, and I thought, man, he was the greatest thing in the world. But they never called him back. So it might have been my fault. But I don't know. I may have killed his career. But I never understood that. He had a good look about him, a good body, and everybody loved him. And, we had like a little 15-minute match. And but he never came back. Never came back.
How much money did you have to slip Jody or JJ or whoever was putting the TVs together to make sure you worked with Jimmy Valiant on TV?
Man, I'm going to tell you, buddy. I'm talking the first Atlanta TV. The biggest thing that amazed me about Boogie is when you see him on TV and then you meet him, you're just amazed at how laid back he is.
Yeah.
And I tell you, nothing upsets him. And I remember he come up to me there in Atlanta with Lawler, and he come up, and he was so laid back, so calm. And I tell you, he's probably, between him and Bob Armstrong are probably the two easiest. Got to put a Honky Tonk Man in there, too. The three easiest guys I've ever worked in my life. I remember first time I worked with Bob Armstrong, I got in the back, and they said, well, you wasn't selling nothing he was doing to you. I said, I didn't know he was doing anything to me. I got heat because he was kicking me and I wasn't selling it. I said I didn't even know he was kicking me. So
if you get hurt working with those guys, it's your fault.
It sure is. My first WWF TV Honky Tonk Man told me, he said, this is going to be the easiest money you ever make, kid. And buddy, it was too. I got to tell you a quick funny story about Honky Tonk. The other night in the dressing room, they were doing these Jerry Lynn retirement matches. and was in a dressing room, and Jerry Lynn was in the back, and he's, you know, he's hurt like all of us are, but he was telling Honky Tonk Man how busted up he was, and that's why he's got to retire. Said his knees were shot, and his, you know, his back's gone, and Honky Tonk Man looked right at him and says, "Well, we're taking bumps." And Jerry Lynn said, "What?" Honky Tonk Man said, "Yeah, just go to a knee like I do." And I'm thinking, man, I may take that advice myself on that. I like that.
What led to you going to Kansas City?
Well, you know, I'd always wanted, and I think we all do when we broke in, we always want to go somewhere and just work, you know, different atmosphere, just for a different office and stuff like that. Of course, you know, I knew Kansas City, knew Harley and Bob Carr, I mean, just from my magazines and stuff. But, of course, Crockett, they came an opening that Crockett was going to buy into Kansas City, and they wanted to send a whole crew out there. Matter of fact, you know, we were told to call it Charlotte, too. We couldn't even call it Kansas City. And, man, I said, Ben, I'm going. And probably the hardest thing I've ever done in my life is my oldest son, little George. He turned 1 year old. I left when he turned on his birthday. We left to go to Kansas City. And, man, we had hopes of going out there and turning that whole territory around. And, I mean, they replaced everything. I mean, from the wrestling rings to the first match underneath guys, they sent everything out there. And we went out there with hopes of we were going to all get rich. And, of course, the smartest thing I ever done was I jumped in a car with Mark Fleming and Rocky King, and I said, guys, we're going to live together for the next year, no matter what. And it turned out to be the smartest thing I ever done because everybody that moved out there bought brand-new homes. And we got out there and saw how bad the territory was. Everybody lost their home in the first month, Bo.
Wow.
But me and Rocky King, I remember this to this day, we pulled in outside of Kansas City, and there's a big flashing sign, like out of a horror movie, on the side of this motel. And it just said, like, $10 a week. Listen, I didn't even care if it had a floor in it. But for $10 a week, buddy, man. So we pulled in. And we checked in that night, and we stayed the whole time. What's funny is a lot of the boys laughed at us at first, said we were staying in the Roach Motel, but it wasn't even 2 months later, everybody's staying in it, Bo. The whole territory was staying in our motel.
I know Kansas City went down, but what did the other towns, how bad did they get?
Man, I'm going to tell you, if you ever think that somebody just throwed a dart at a map and said, we're going to run a show here, that's what this territory was. I mean, none of the towns, every now and then they would sell a show to like one of them army bases and you'd have a decent crowd then. But I remember many nights we'd call back. I remember Sam Houston would call back to Dusty or Jim Crockett and say, hey, there's 10 people here. In Wichita, Kansas. Hey, there's 10 people. Do we still run? And of course, the greatest thing in the world, Bo, is I was in the ring every night. I would not trade nothing for that. Now, we were starving, and, buddy, I learned to make a mean tomato soup out of ketchup packs and water, let me tell you. But, man, we were in the ring, and what was so amazing, they didn't give you no time limits because there was nobody there anyway. And Crockett paid rent on some of these buildings for, you know, 6 hours. You go out there and do 30 minutes. Nobody cared. So, and I was in the ring with, of course, Denny Brown every night and a lot of guys like that. You can't do nothing but learn from them. They were so good. And so that part of it, man, I loved it. But see, a lot of the boys, all I done, Bo, is every penny I made, what little bit I made, I sent back home. I remember Italian Stallion, before we left Kansas City, he went into Dusty's office and said, Dusty, I just bought a brand new house in Charlotte. I can't go. Dusty said, kid, I hope that house has got wheels on it. I thought, man, it's a cutthroat business, buddy. So I just sent back to Charlotte what little money I had. And I tell you what's amazing, after about 7 or 8 months, I saw the writing on the wall. I said, brother, I'm out of here. I can go back home and sleep in my own bed. And I tell you, the towns would be good. Like Ricky Morton still laughs at me today. I mean, I would tell him and Robert how bad it was, and then they'd come out there with Rock and Roll at Midnight and Flair and Dusty, and they'd sell it out. And Ricky would say, George, what are you complaining about? Look at that crowd. And I'd say, but Punky, y'all get to go home. You know, we don't. And they tried with, like, Sam Houston against Warlord, but bless their heart, that didn't draw a dime. It didn't draw a dime. And I finally said, man, I can go home, sleep in my own bed, and do a couple of jobs on TV twice a week and see my son and live happily ever after. So they came out there for a big show a week later. I tell you, the biggest house ever out there was at Memorial Hall, Starcade, when they had Starcade here, I think it was in Atlanta, and they showed it on pay-per-view TV out there. So we got to work some matches, live matches, and then they showed the pay-per-view after the show. Now, they sold it out then, the Memorial Hall, but no more after that. I had times out there I remember the first time I ever tagged with Rufus R. Jones. Now, that was a good little house, and I never forget, that was one of the greatest reactions. They talk about The Undertaker getting a big pop and all this, but to be there as Rufus's partner when, you know, we got in there and they got the little heat up on me and I tagged Rufus and he come in, just to be part of that, I wouldn't trade anything for that. I become good friends with Rufus and, of course, I always loved him from the Carolinas too, so got to meet a lot. Bob Brown, I mean, a lot of people talk bad about Bob Brown, but see, what they've done to me, Bo, is they told me I was finished. When I talked with Dusty and said, I'm coming home, he said, well, just finish up your last week. I said, okay, I'll be glad to. So I already turned my keys in, that little cheap motel, packed everything in my little Nissan, because I was going to sleep in my car for a week. And the way the booking sheet come out, man, I was off Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. And they wanted me to work Friday and then come home. And I'll never forget this, and I love him for it to this day. I went up to Ron West, who was helping book, and Ron, I said, buddy, I need to go home. I said, I can't live here in my car for 4 days and not work, and then work Friday. And he looked at me, I'll never forget it, and I kiss him right in the forehead every time I see him. As he said, George, you leave now. He said, and buddy, he said, I'll take any heat for it. He said, but you can leave now. And buddy, I did too. And I didn't stop till I got to Charlotte, my brother. But I'll never forget Ron West doing that for me. And I mean, I wouldn't have traded it. People said, well, why'd you go? I mean, you didn't really have a choice. I mean, Dusty said you're going. And, I mean, I got to tag along with Rocky and you know. So I wouldn't trade that for nothing. But that was a good learning experience. I was out there for about 7. Of course, after I came home, they shut the whole territory down. And, the thing I hate, I couldn't do it. Right after that's when Crockett bought Florida. And so the Mulkeys and Colt Steele and a lot of those guys, man, they didn't even get to stay home. They came to Charlotte. I always joke with them and said they hung a right before they got to Charlotte and went to Florida.
Yeah.
And, man, I couldn't do that. I said, I thank the good Lord I didn't do it. I stayed right here and, like to say, the rest is history. But, man, that was a great time, especially when I was in the ring out there, I was the happiest person in the world, Bo.
It was going to college for you. You got an education out there second to none.
Man, I did. And, you know, what was hard on me is as I had done give up drinking years ago, done gave my life up to the Lord and just was really serving him, and I didn't party. I didn't, you know, I didn't do any of that. So, and I'm proud of it, but it was a lonely time. I mean, I tell people all the time when I talk to these youth groups and stuff that, you know, even during that time, I was human. I mean, but I didn't fall back, but it was hard. I mean, the temptation, I mean, I'm a, you know, man, I'm human, but I stayed so close to the Lord, and that's when I really started having a quiet time. I never even knew what a quiet time with the Lord was. I thought it's just saying a few prayers and going about your business. But, man, when you wasn't working, you didn't have to get on the road to town. Some of those towns were horrifying out there. But I got so close to the Lord out there because I knew he was the only thing that I had. And it was some, you know, a lot of downtime before you left for the towns. And so I really had a pastor here in the Carolinas that wrote me every single week. And he's retired now down in Anderson, South Carolina. He's about 90 years old. But I thank him every day that he sent me a church bulletin, and he wrote me every week to just see how I was doing, man. So a lot of people kept me intact, and I wouldn't have traded that for nothing, buddy. I wouldn't, Bert.
Yeah. That's it. We got nothing else to cling to.
That's right, buddy.
Sometimes when you realize he's all you got, that's when you learn that's all you need.
Well, you know, one of the first quotes that me and Mark James agreed to put in my book is a religious professor, Bobby, come up to me a few years ago and said, I want to interview you about wrestling. He's from South Carolina. I said, all right. So we met up here at a little old Bojangles chicken place. And you know me, Bob, I'm looking to get a free meal out of
right,
it.
Right,
that's all I'm looking for. So anyway, we sit down, and he was a sarcastic jerk. And the first thing he said, why does it seem that old wrestlers, when they don't have anything else, they find God? And that, just for some reason, first thing I thought of, I said, Bobby, what you just said. I said, sir, I said, that's because they find out that God is the only one that don't leave them. And boy,
amen.
He shut up right then, man, and changed the subject and kind of calmed down a little bit. But that's why. But I'm so glad y'all had Mark on here. I got to plug him for, man, he's a, but I tell you, he took a chance on me, and I'm indebted to him. You know, well, you know how hard it is when you go to get a book done. And,
yeah.
You know, buddy, I tell you, Mark is just a tremendous guy, and I love him so much. He took a chance. I mean, he told me, first time I met him, he said, you ought to do a book. I told him he's crazy. You know, I said, man, I ain't got time. I don't know how to do nothing. He said, here, just. And I tell you, when you trust somebody, Bo, you know, with your life story, it's a scary thing, Bobby. And,
yeah.
I tell you, you know, Mark just worked. I can honestly say, I can tell him anything. We've become so close. But I can look back, and I would not change one thing in that book. I mean, not one thing. I mean, I gave him, you know, 400 pictures, and he just said, trust me. And, you know, to a wrestler, we don't even know what them words mean.
No.
And so I'm just so indebted to him. I'm so proud of the book that we come up with. And it's just, you know, it's I'm constantly getting emails of people that it's helping. It's, you know, there's a few lives been changed, and people just been saying, hey, I didn't know you could do this and still serve the Lord. And, you know, the greatest compliment I ever got was when I gave Ole one of the books, and he said, man, he said, there's about 3 pages of wrestling and about 300 about God. I said, Ole, that's a good thing. So yeah. That was pretty neat. So,
when your life story, when the troubles that we have lived through and dealt with are used to help somebody else just by reading our life story. So
that's right.
I get emails about my book, too, all the time. People just tell me, you know, they just... Man, I can't believe it. You know, but hey, we lived it.
We did, but you know, when my first come out, I remember I had a lady that bought one of the first ones, and she read it. She wrote me, and she said, man, there's nothing. She said, I'm kind of disappointed. She said, there's nothing dark in here. And I said, what? And she said, well, you know, there's nothing like dark. There's no, like, you know, sad stuff on people's lives. I said, lady, you know, and I always joke with them both and say, listen, 50 years from now, when I'm in a nursing home trying to sell my book to some old lady, you know, at the bingo table, brother, I don't want nothing. I don't want to read about nothing sad, you know, or nothing dark. I thought, are y'all crazy? Man, but I guess people just look for that. But I knew then, and Mark agreed, I wanted this to uplift people, you know. And, Bo, we've all, Bobby, too, we've all seen enough bad stuff in our business to write 10 books.
Yeah.
Just in the last month, we've had just horrendous, just awful stuff.
Exactly. That's right. And I said, man, I'm not.
As I said, big thing with George's book is he wanted his book his kids could read.
That's right.
His grandkids later on, you know, and it's like, you know, you can't be putting that crap out. There's been enough, you know, there's 4,000... quote unquote shoot interviews, everybody talking bad about everybody else.
That's
people
right.
want that, go buy that. You know, this is this is George's life story. Let it be about George. What he wants, the story he wants to tell. That's what I tell everybody I work with. I said, tell the story you want to tell. You know, if your mom was gonna read it, your kid was gonna read it, whoever is gonna read it, do it right. Don't
That's
regret
right.
it later on.
That's exactly right. And, Bo, what's helped me a lot, and I've told you, I share this with Mark all the time, is, you know, I've been able to share my book with, like, Ricky Steamboat and Terry Taylor and guys like that, and I've had so many. I ain't lying. It makes me feel so good when I get a text from Terry Taylor, and he'll say, man, me and Steamboat's here on a plane, and we're laughing because we're reading this story out of your book. And, you know, and I wrote it for them, too, because I want to know, you know, I tell all these boys what these guys meant to me. And if it keeps Jay Youngblood's name alive or Gene Anderson's name alive,
yeah.
I mean, what's so neat about my story about Gene is Mark found the greatest pitcher in the world of Gene after that story of Gene stretching that guy, Gene looking through this curtain just like, it scares you to death to see the pitcher. And I said, Mark, that's the perfect pitcher for that story. And you know me, I'm such an egomaniac. I told Mark I was going to have everybody that ever met me in the business write a forward. And I've had guys say, man, George, your book ain't nothing but a book of forwards.
I don't know if you heard at the beginning of the show when I was talking about, you know, when I saw Mark out in West Tennessee and he told me he was going to start on the book. I said, if George would just write it the way he talks, it'll be great. You know, it is.
Well,
I love the
that.
Book. I love it. And, you know, and then I appreciate the fact you put me in the beginning of it, and thank you for that.
Yeah.
I mean, I've had a lot of people tell me about, hey, I didn't even know you got along with George. I said, I'm one of the few that can.
Yeah, that's right. That's about right. You and Mark, well, Bobby, too. I got three friends in the business. I'm telling you. But, you know, when I just had a guy get one this week, and I told Mark, you know, the guy told me, he said, George, I feel like, after I read it, that we're just sitting around talking. And to me, that's the greatest compliment to Mark and what he did with my book, is I wanted people to feel that way. And he hit a home run with mine. I mean, it's just, I'm so excited. And like Mark said, I'm not ashamed to mail it to pastors. I mean, I've had several of the other guys' books so I got pastor friends that love the business, but a lot of these other books, I couldn't even give it to them. Some of them, I put a rubber band around them and throwed them under the bed, and they took them out. I mean, some of them, buddy, you just can't. But I'm so happy with mine. I tell you, I'm pretty excited about it. Still.
I see it everywhere. It's still selling. I see people with it in towns all over the place.
Well, you know, Bo, I just sent Mark an email a couple weeks ago. A guy was in Mississippi, and he got one. A promoter had bought it and gave it to one of the guys on the show. And the guy actually read the book, and he turned his life over to the Lord. And I tell you, that's nothing on me at all, but that's what, and me and Mark constantly tell each other, that's what we wanted this book to do. And so I get so excited. Tell you a funny quick story. Tommy Dreamer texted one of my guys, Jake Manning, the other day and said that I had sold one of my books, well, I gave him one of my books to Necro Butcher, of all people. Necro was supposed to be at a show. Well, he gets to read my book in the airport. Who gets to read my book in the airport and missed his plane. That is a truth. He missed his flight, read the whole book in the airport, and then realized he'd missed his flight. He even missed the show that night. I thought that was kind of neat. So I got one fan of the book anyway, Necro Butcher. So.
What George? What led when you went from doing the WCW TVs to going up and doing the WWF TVs?
Well, you know what's so funny is Gene and Nelson, they knew everybody, of course, in the business, and WWF just called down one day and said, "Can you send us some new guys?" And that's what was so funny about even the story in my book about the Hardy Boys. You know, me and Stallion, we took the Hardys to their first TVs, and we charged them a booking fee. And I've had so many guys, the Hardy Boys got hot over that. What nobody understands, Bo, is when Gene and Nelson booked us, we paid them old timers. We paid them guys a booking fee.
Yeah.
I didn't care. You know, I've been in the business 20 years, and I still pay Nelson. Gene, and if you understand this business, there's no way Gene and Nelson's going to do all the phone calls, line everything up, and book all of us if they're not going to get something out of it. You know, and I had no problem with that at all. So that man, we, for about 3 or 4 years, man, I was doing, and see, I loved everybody. I wasn't under contract. I could work for anybody. So I was doing TVs. I was doing TV Day for Crockett. And then at the end of the week, but the first week, I was all over that WWF TV. And, man, they were sending like 15 guys up there. I tell you, my first TV, when we landed, the plane was late. So the nearest motel was $100. And we put like 20 guys in a room, and I knew WWF was going to reimburse me, but I was so afraid. I said, I've never spent $100 for anything in my life, not even a car, much less a motel room. And I was so afraid and so worried that WWF was going to cuss us out. We get to TV, and I want to tell you, that's when I realized how big that company was. Is, I mean, of course, they reimbursed me the $100. Didn't think twice about it. They paid us in cash. I'm going to tell you, early on, I was kind of seeing when some of the guys, why some of the guys were jumping ship. I mean, first time, first TV, I saw like 8 transfer trucks, Bo, of WWF TV stuff. And when you, you know, back down here in the South, man, we're used to a ring being on an old flatbed trailer, you know?
Yeah.
And you get up there and you realize, and that's why in my book I said, you know, Dorothy, we are not in Charlotte, Kansas City anymore, buddy. This is a big time. And my first guy, it was so weird. The first person I ever met was Vince McMahon. We just happened to walk in the hall when he was walking out of his office. And, Bo, I'll tell you to this day, buddy, he knew. This is why that company is so big. It was me, Tommy Angel, Larry Stevens, David Isley. Vince McMahon knew. He called every one of us by name, Bo, and we were nobody. But he knew. I always heard that he knew every area, everything that goes on in that company, he knows about it. And I thought, man. And then you get there and you see that whole machine and how it works. And I remember they were the first company that fed the boys. I thought that was the greatest thing. Man, I ain't never put so many biscuits and egg rolls in my pocket in my life, Bo James. I thought, like, man, they take care of the boys up here.
How many times did you have your hair cut and a snake put on you?
Man, let me tell you. I remember first time Jake Roberts come up and said, are you afraid of snakes? I said, well, Jake, I don't know. I said, I ain't never been close to one. He said, well, we're fixing to find out. And I about killed his career. I mean, he DDT'd me, and I'm laying there, and he throwed that snake on me, and I come right up. I said, enough of this. So I was probably knocked out the shortest time on the DDT that you ever seen, because that old thing got on me, buddy, and I got right out of there. And it, of course, you know, when Brutus Beefcake was cutting her hair, a lot of people look back at my old Crockett matches, and I just let my hair, I look like Gene Simmons. And I didn't tell anybody because I knew I was going to WWF a week later, and they would cut my hair just because it looked so bad. And I never forget being on that plane, and people like Ricky Nelson would say, they ain't cutting my hair, I just had it done. But I'd be begging. We got up there about 5 weeks in a row. Bo, they gave you $300 for the match, and then they gave you $350 extra for getting your hair cut. Plus, they kept a full-time beautician on staff that fixed your hair up when he got done with it. So 5 weeks in a row, they cut my hair. And finally, Jay Strongbow said, George, enough already. He said, we can't cut your hair anymore. And Brutus was so good, he'd just come up and ask you. You know, he'd tell you, he wouldn't just start cutting. He'd say, you want me to cut the front or the back? So it was me. I didn't care. I said, brother, just cut wherever you want, man. It'll grow back. So that was an amazing time. But after about 5 weeks, they said, that's enough, George. But I got to work, you know, a lot of their great guys up there. And you know how these territories are, Bo. You know everybody.
Yeah.
I remember one night, Crockett ran, like, Baltimore, and right across the river, WWF ran the same night. And both towns practically sold out. The territory, the business was so hot. But that night, we all stayed in the same hotel. So all the boys from different companies, of course, this was way before the kayfabe sheets or anything, we all ate together. And I thought that was the neatest thing that, Vince and Crockett may hate each other, but we're all one family, Bo, you know. And
yeah. We
just all ate together, and that's what was so amazing. So when I left here to go to WWF TVs and work up there some, it was same, a lot of the same guys. Big Boss Man, all them that was down here is Big Bubba. I mean, just changed gimmicks and just got to work, continue to work. I remember one time I got out of the ring with Jake Roberts and Dutch Mantel was up there, and he said, man, George, he said, how many years of experience was in that ring? And I said, Dutch, I said, if you include the snake, it's about 400 years of experience in that ring. Oh, and he got tickled over that. So, but they had their nutcases, too. I mean, I went out there with some of their guys up there that just, it's a good, I can't believe I'm still alive. Because they were going through that monster age up there, too, remember one time, Bo, I walked in the dressing room, and Jake Roberts had his snake. Bad News Brown had that lizard dragon-looking thing. Rat. I think he had a big rat.
Yeah, he had a rat,
Steamboat had his dragon. The British Bulldog had his dog, Coco Beware had his bird, and I stood there and looked around. I thought, what in the world has wrestling come to? There was as many animals in that ring as there was the guy. But I tell you what impressed me more than anything, and I'll move on, is they paid us that night. You know, when I worked for Crockett or WCW, even Bill Watts, they mailed you a check. They mailed you a check. Man, I went to WWF, and it was Bruno's old manager, Arnold Skorklin. They said, have you seen him yet? And I said, what do you mean? They said, well, go see him to get paid. Brother, I went right to him. He popped open that brand-new Heidelberg, brother, and paid me and brand-new cash, $100 bills, buddy. I thought, man. But I tell you, the best story was when everybody was leaving Crockett to go to WWF. And one day, Dusty told JJ, said, well, call George South. He's always available. And JJ said, I can't. He's gone to WWF too. Man, we all jumped ship, buddy. I think, man.
How did when Dusty went to, well, you were there when he went to New York? How did they treat Dusty after he had been the booker and the man in charge in Charlotte for all those years, running head to head with them?
Well, you know, the one thing that, and I think they still tried to play a big rib on Dusty, but he was over so much. That I tell everybody they could have sent him to the ring in a potato sack, and he would have got it over. But I think I liked about when Dusty went up there, they let him choose his opponents for TV. And his first TV ever up there, he worked Mike Davis, and the second TV, he worked with me. I remember Mike Davis come up and said, I want to be able to go out there and have a match with Dusty. He said, I was Dusty. That was right after he come up from Florida. Remember, he'd done that with Kevin Sullivan deal where he was Dusty. So I love that. But Dusty just did what he's always done. He went out there, and, you know, he got it over. And I thought, man, they could have – I tell you a funny story about that is we walked by the interview room one time, and that's when he had – remember that black lady, Sapphire, that was with Dusty? They were trying to get her to do an interview. And she was doing it, bless her heart, but she wasn't sounding black enough. That's what they told her. They said, we want you to draw this black crowd, and you're not sounding black enough. And she said, well, I'm trying. And they said, well, here. They called Dusty in there. It's a true story, BoJ. They called Dusty in there to teach her how to talk black. Can you believe that, Bob? And she caught on. And I thought that was the greatest thing in the world. I thought, buddy, I haven't seen everything now. But Dusty taught her how to do an interview as a black person.
I love it.
I thought, man, that's the greatest thing I ever seen.
George, a lot of people don't know it, but you and Stal ran towns everywhere, up and down the East Coast. What made you start running?
Well, you know, Bo, I always wanted to do it, but I remember when Stallion was down in Florida after we just left Kansas City, and I was here making a little bit of money. Well, Stallion, all the boys were down there starving. Matter of fact, the territory in Florida was so bad that they started making some of the baby faces share some of their gimmick money with the heels because everybody was starving. I remember Stan called me one night from Tampa, and he said, George, he said, I'm coming home. He said, we got to do something. And I said, well, we can always buy a ring. He said, well, let's do it. And the next day, believe it or not, we called Ted Allen. That's how long I know Ted Allen. We called Ted Allen, and that weekend, me and Stan were so stupid, we booked the show. They didn't even have a ring, hoping that we'd get a ring up here. We bought the ring from Ted Allen on a Saturday and ran a show that night. And we didn't draw but two people. But you'd have thought it was the Great American Bash, Bo. And I tell you, you're talking about holding a grudge. We paid a couple guys that night. I'll never forget, I took $5 out of my pocket to pay a guy. And to this day, he complains about that. But I'll tell you what, Bo, I've never used him since.
Yeah.
I've never used him. I couldn't believe the guy took my last $5. But we just started running our own shows, and then, we got to where we were making some money, and it was so funny. I remember the first time Wahoo ever worked for us. He was so excited. He come up, and he put wrist tape. I'll never forget this. He put wrist tape on Stallion. I walked in the dressing room, and he was putting wrist tape on Stallion's arms. And I said, Chief? I said, what are you doing? He said, no, I work for y'all tonight. And he kind of laughed. And I thought that was so neat that we were able to, I tell you, talking about Necro Butcher, he come up to me the other week, first time I ever met him, and said, you don't know me, but you bled on me. He said, you bled on me in West Virginia. I said, what He said, man, I was sitting ringside as a kid, and you and Stan was fighting, and you bled on me. And I'm thinking, oh, my gosh, I'm the one to blame for Necro Butcher, Bo. What the heck? But we ran. I laugh all these guys up in West Virginia. You know, I go up there some now for some guys that we both know, Bo. And me and Stan,
yeah.
I joke with them and say, man, me and Stan was losing money up here 20 years ago. But
yeah.
There wasn't a lot of guys running, especially the Charlotte area. So, we did good for a long, long time. Of course, I still see Stan. He's out of the business now, and he's doing real, real good. And I just think he's smartened up and got out of it. And I stayed in it. But plus, we got to still do some of our TV matches, you know, TV shows. So, the TV shots. So, we did good for a long time. So, plus, we were one of the first guys to start doing some of the. Now, I don't even think you can get on the Navy bases anymore.
They've about shut all of them down after 9/11, and all the crooks have been through there and everything else.
That's right.
Yeah.
We had a heck of a deal up here on some of them where they just paid us and gave us a little guarantee and was able to bring some names in. But, you know, the stupid outlaw wrestlers in our business will kill everything. And we had five Navy bases where they were paying us guaranteed money and we were bringing some names in. These two, I wish I could think of their names. I tell you, these two outlaw guys, never done nothing in the business, couldn't work a lick, went in there. I mean, they mailed a letter to the government and said, why are you paying these guys when we'll come in there and do a show for free? Well, naturally, the government thought, free? We'll do it. So they kicked us out, brought these two goofs in. Well, without any money, you can't bring no names in, Bo. So they tried. They run two shows. And next thing I know, the government shut down wrestling on all the Navy bases. We tried to tell them, you know. So, but that goes to show. I tell everybody all the time, most of these wrestlers, if you want to meet them, don't ever meet them. I'm going to tell you. It'll ruin it, Bo. It'll ruin it. Oh, my gosh.
I was in the dressing room in Carolina a couple weeks ago. Some of us were talking about you and Stale. And there's guys that I think, and a lot of other people think, they should still be paying you guys. Because they would have never made it to where they made it to without you. They would have never left Carolinas or West Virginia or wherever they came from. They would have never been seen.
And you know, Bo, a lot of people don't understand this. A lot of people don't know the heat that we got. I mean, we took a lot of guys to TV, and they would screw up a spot or something, and they wouldn't get. I remember we took one guy to WWF TV, and he worked with, like, Undertaker. And Undertaker, no matter what Undertaker done to this guy, he grinned. He had the awfulest. He grinned the whole time. I mean, the Tombstone Piledriver, he got up grinning. And I'll never forget, they went nuts on me and Stallion. Where'd you get this guy? So we got a lot of heat from a lot of the fans. Didn't know. Every time, if a guy screwed up in a match or it didn't look good or didn't have the right gear on or something, man, they come to me and Stallion. So I tell guys all the time, there's no way that I was going to take responsibility for you and not make some money off of it. I was going to try to anyway. And the biggest thing, of course, was my guys now laugh at me because, you know, the Hardy Boys, and they had heat with us for a while because they said men Stan took advantage of them. But then you look and see the money they've made, and my guys tell me they joke. Exactly. And my guys joke with me now. They say, George, could you please take advantage of me? could you please take advantage of me, please, if it, you know, puts me in a brand-new car and WWF champ? So, and the Hardy Boys work their butts off, and they deserve what they're getting. But there had to be an initial meeting. That's what this, you know, a lot of people forget. Vince Stallion took them to their first time Vince McMahon ever met them, Bo. We were standing right there. He told us they were too little. He said, I can't use them. So the first TVs they ever went to, they didn't get to work. But you know, Vince Stallion, we thought the next week, man, ain't nobody going to remember these guys. We'll take them back. So we took them back the next week. And, of course, they got on TV and started doing all these crazy bumps. And, buddy, next thing you know, it's history, buddy. But there had to be an initial meeting. I tell you, we took men on a mission one time to meet Ole. You'll love this story, Bobby. We took them to Atlanta, told Ole about them for 2 weeks. Here's these two huge black guys, Mohawks. Man, they've never seen nothing like it. And so we told men on a mission, when you meet Ole, don't matter what he says to you, don't let it get to you. Just laugh about it. We took him in TV in Atlanta, and you can imagine the first thing Ole called him. Now, Mabel, the big one, was okay. But Mo got very upset. Very upset. I was ready to fight. And Ole looked right at me and Stallion, and he said, tell them to get their bags and leave. And I cussed those guys for 2 weeks. That's when they went up to Memphis for a little bit and then went on to WWF. But
yeah.
At first, Ole made so much sense. He said, if they can't take me calling them names, what are they going to do when 2,000 people start chanting at them? And he was just testing them, Bo, right there,
yeah.
And they felt it. And Buddy, Ben Stan yelled at them all the 400 miles back home to Charlotte. What was y'all thinking? We told you what he was going to do. And they failed it right then, Buddy, that quick. Man.
Huh. Every day's a test. You pass or you fail.
That's exactly right, Buddy. And most of them, even with me now, they fail. I'm telling you. Oh, my God. About 4 weeks ago, I slammed. I told you this, but we laughed about it the other night. I slammed one of my regular guys, and just body slammed him, and man, it hurt him. I mean, he hit, boom, and it hurt. And he kind of grabbed his side, and he made like a little groaning sound. Well, I had this young kid, about 18, you know, cocky. He come, I swear to you, Bo, I wish I'd had a camera. After I slammed my guy, this cocky little brat, he walked right up my face, and he said, do you expect me to make those funny noises, Bo? I could hear Gene Anderson ringing in my ear.
Close
and I'm going to tell you, brother, I emptied my pocket, my little whistle and stopwatch. And now, I couldn't move the next week. I couldn't move for 4 days afterwards. But, brother, I had that guy screaming, Buddy. And it's funny because all of my other students, I think they all peed in their pants. But I had that, and that guy quit, and I'm glad he did. And he never came back. But, when I had him, Bo, and he was squealing, I said, are these them funny noises you were talking about? And I let him know then that I've got too many friends, Bo, too many old-timers that hurt. You know, every time they walk or they try to sleep or they
That's
just
it.
Because of this business, Buddy. And I tell you, that won't happen again, I'm going to tell you. But that don't happen much. Most of the guys are kind of respectful, these young kids, but I had a dad bring a kid to me last week. The kid's playing his dad burned PlayStation. His game. While he's talking to me, Bo. I mean, on his phone. And his dad, first thing his dad said, well, who have you trained? I said, Dad, if you got to ask me that, then you need to leave. And I said, who's training anyway, you or your boy? He said, well, my son is. Son's about 17, had his nose down in that little video game on the phone. I reached up and grabbed the phone, and I said, is he going to sign up tonight or not? Dad said, well, I don't know yet. We want to watch. I said, we're not going to watch. And the kid said, Dad, I'm ready to leave. He said, I'm ready to leave. And they turned around and walked right out the door. Walked out the door. So, you know, I'm probably going to end up paying rent on my building myself because I'm going to run everybody off. So, I need to smarten up and realize that all the goofballs is the one with the money. Bo?
Yeah. I'll tell you this. I want to say this to you, George, in public where everybody can hear it. Anywhere I'm at where your boys are at, I enjoy it. If I see Jake or Caleb or any of them, I know I got somebody to talk to who's intelligent in the dressing room.
I appreciate that.
And
you know,
I don't have to listen to no goofiness or none of that.
Bo, I appreciate that. You know, one of the greatest compliments I got is when Jake Manning, I joke with him that he's worked with Lawler about 3 or 4 times, and Lawler loves working. And what's so amazing about Lawler is they worked a fairgrounds somewhere in Tennessee a few months ago, and Jake said Lawler come up, started calling a backdrop, and Jake just naturally thinks it's for him to take the backdrop. They get out there, and Lawler said, no, I'm taking it. So Jake, he didn't know what to do, man. He's slamming Lawler and everything else. But Lawler, I never forget, Lawler came back and thanked me for those matches he had with Jake. And that's a great, you know, I'm not bragging, but that makes me feel good as heck. And I appreciate you telling me that, Bo, that these guys, they respect everybody and they work hard. And just for Jake to go out there with Lawler, and I knew I didn't have to worry about, you know, Lawler getting hurt or anything like that. And
yeah.
He just did it again with Goldust a couple weeks ago. And what's funny is Goldust, the promoter wanted me to work Goldust, but I spoke right up. I said, I'm not taking his finish. You're going to be crazy. So that's a great, great compliment. I appreciate that, Bo, that these guys do. You know, they, and I tell these young kids that I try to train, man, just have some common sense about you. And but you know, I get reports all the time from WWE down there in Florida from some guys down there that said they'll test them. And like before training, they'll ask them, you know, how many of you people know who the Anderson Brothers are? Or do you know who the Valiant Brothers are? Or do you know, you know, Dojo or somebody like that? And a lot of those kids down there, they don't have a clue, Bo.
Yeah.
They don't have a clue who these people are. And,
see,
you know,
even more reason we're talking about, we got to save our history. We have to tell it and tell it right.
That's exactly right, buddy. And I tell you, that, you know, there's a right way, as you know, Bobby knows, there's a right way and there's a wrong way, buddy. And as long as we can breathe and fight and yell, we're going to keep it. You know, that's why we go to a lot of these shows, Bo, and I'll work with you or I'll take one of my kids and work with them. You know, I tell these guys all the time, the object ain't to get hurt. I think they think the object is to get hurt. And you know how I feel about setting that ring up early and the guys want to get in there and take a few bumps.
I feel the same way.
Oh, my gosh. I blowed like three gaskets on that conversation. But and then I look at them and tell them, hey, ain't the object not to take bumps? But when I was a kid, if I saw Blackjack and Flair come out or Paul Jones come out and bump before the show, that would have broke my heart, Bo.
Yeah. Or sitting over there talking to each other in front of everybody.
Oh, is that, you know, the people are coming in, they buy a ticket and come in, and you got two guys working over their match in the ring. And I'm thinking, oh, my gosh, oh, my gosh.
Quick story. I'll tell you, this is the gospel truth. I went with Charlie Smith one night. He's going to sell his gimmicks at the show. And I don't go to a lot of independent shows because I get mad. So I'm sitting there with Charlie. He's got his gimmicks set up on the table. These two guys come out and get in the ring. And I said, Charlie, what are they doing? And they've started stretching. So I didn't think much about it. And then all of a sudden they get up and they start doing high spots. And I said, Charlie, what are they doing? He said, they're working on their match. I said, pardon me? He said, they're working on their match. Well, the people start coming in and they don't quit.
Oh, gosh.
They get out of the ring. They go to the dressing room. The bell rings for the first match. The two guys come out. The referee comes out of the dressing room and he's got a mask on.
Oh, my God.
And I told Charlie, I said, Charlie, I said, I've been around this business since 1968. I said, I started 14 years old running errands. I said, I've been around ever since then. I said, this is the first time in my life I've ever been ashamed to be associated with this. I said, I hope nobody recognizes me.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, it's crazy.
You know what's amazing is, I mean, you honest, and I take up for high spots, but we both do business with them. You know, and they've got like $100-$150 wrestling boot that, and I know it's not what we get or one that'll last you for a while, but I tell these kids that come to work in a or go to the ring in a combat boot or a tennis shoe, well, there's no excuse that you can't get you a pair of boots nowadays.
Yeah.
And they just all, I don't understand it. Some kid will come in eating, you know, $15 worth of Happy Meals, but he can't spend no money on tights. I don't understand that.
Yeah, I don't get it either.
I don't understand it, buddy. But we'll keep at it. We'll keep at it and keep yelling and screaming.
That's it. So, hey, we got 2 minutes left. Mark and George, tell us where we can get your book at.
Well, I'll let Mark talk. Mark, you go ahead, buddy.
Okay, you breathe, George. Just breathe, son. My books, you can go to MemphisWrestlingHistory.com or Memphis Wrestling Book, either one. It's got linked to all the books on Amazon. All the books are on Amazon.
George, I know you've always got yours at wherever you're at. I know you got a trunk full of them.
Yes, sir, buddy. I tell people, man, you can buy it through Mark. Buddy, I'll bring it to your house if you want it. I'm telling you. Just tell me what time of supper is. I'll bring it to you. No, thank you. Real quick, I want to thank you, Mark, buddy. You know how much you mean to me.
Yeah.
And I tell you, my kids, my grandbabies, they read my book all the time with pictures. And you know what's so amazing real quick is I had a brand-new grandbaby, and we had a deadline. And Mark held on to get that picture of my brand new grandbaby in that book. So, man, I'm tickled. And because if he gets older and can stretch me, he's going to be glad I put his picture in that. But, Mark, I love you, buddy, and appreciate you so much.
You too, George. Oh, yes, George.
That's it. All right, we're down the last few seconds, George. Thank you. Mark, thank you for joining us. Jerry Oates will be back with me and Bobby next week. I don't know exactly what we got going on here next week, but in 2 weeks we've got the one and only handsome Jimmy Boogie Woogie Man Valley here with us.
Man, I'm just getting started, BoJ. You cut me off.
I may have you back here next week then, George.
Yeah.
I'll be back. I'll still be talking. Thank you, guys.
Good night, everybody.
Yes, sir, buddy. Love you. Bye-bye.
All right.
We thank you for listening to this broadcast, a production brought to you by GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com and the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GWH for nostalgia, upcoming events, and more. As always, GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com thanks you for your continued support.